Chapter 16, When Scientists Know Sin. The mind of man, how far will it advance? Where will its daring impudence find limits? If human villainy and human life shall wax in due proportion, if the son shall always grow in wickedness past his father, the gods must add another world to this, that all the sinners may have space enough. Euripides. Hippolytus, 428 BC. In a post-war meeting with President Harry S. Truman, J. Robert Oppenheimer, the scientific director of the Manhattan Nuclear Weapons Project, mournfully commented that scientists had bloody hands. They had now known sin. Afterwards, Truman instructed his aides that he never wished to see Oppenheimer again. Sometimes, scientists are castigated for doing evil, and sometimes for warning about the evil uses to which science may be put. More often, science is taken to task because it and its products are said to be morally neutral, ethically ambiguous, as readily employed in the service of evil as of good. This is an old indictment. It goes back probably to the flaking of stone tools and the domestication of fire. Since technology has been with our ancestral line from before the first human, since we are a technological species, this problem is not so much one of science as of human nature. By this, I don't mean that science has no responsibility for the misuse of its findings. It has profound responsibility, and the more powerful its products, the greater its responsibility. Like assault weapons and market derivatives, the technologies that allow us to alter the global environment that sustains us should mandate caution and prudence. Yes, it's the same old humans who have made it so far. Yes, we're developing new technologies, as we always have. But when the weaknesses we've always had join forces with a capacity to do harm on an unprecedented planetary scale, something more is required of us. An emerging ethic that must also be established on an unprecedented planetary scale. Sometimes, scientists try to have it both ways. To take credit for those applications of science that enrich our lives, but to distance themselves from the instruments of death, intentional and inadvertent, that also trace back to scientific research. The Australian philosopher John Passmore writes in his book Science and Its Critics, "The Spanish Inquisition sought to avoid direct responsibility for the burning of heretics by handing them over to the secular arm. To burn them itself, it piously explained, would be wholly inconsistent with its Christian principles. Few of us would allow the Inquisition thus easily to wipe its hands clean of bloodshed. It knew quite well what would happen. Equally, where the technological application of scientific discoveries is clear and obvious, as when a scientist works on nerve gases, he cannot properly claim that such applications are none of his business, merely on the ground that it is the military forces, not scientists, who use the gases to disable or kill. This is even more obvious when the scientist deliberately offers help to governments in exchange for funds. If a scientist or a philosopher accepts funds from some such body as an Office of Naval Research, then he is cheating if he knows his work will be useless to them, and must take some responsibility for the outcome if he knows that it will be useful. He is subject, properly subject, to praise or blame in relation to any innovations which flow from his work." An important case history is provided by the career of the Hungarian-born physicist Edward Teller. Teller was marked at a young age by the Bela Kun communist revolution in Hungary. in which the property of middle-class families like his was expropriated, and by losing part of his leg in a streetcar accident, leaving him in permanent pain. His early contributions ranged from quantum mechanical selection rules and solid-state physics to cosmology. It was he who chauffeured the physicist Leo Szilard to the vacationing Albert Einstein on Long Island in July 1939, a meeting that led to the historic letter from Einstein to President Franklin Roosevelt, urging, in view of both scientific and political events in Nazi Germany, that the United States develop a fission, or atomic bomb. Recruited to work on the Manhattan Project, Teller arrived at Los Alamos and promptly refused to cooperate. Not because he was dismayed at what an atomic bomb might do, but just the opposite. Because he wanted to work on a much more destructive weapon, the fusion or thermonuclear or hydrogen bomb. While there is a practical upper limit on the yield or destructive energy of an atomic bomb, there is no such limit for a hydrogen bomb. But a hydrogen bomb needs an atomic bomb as trigger. After the fission bomb was invented, after Germany and Japan surrendered, after the war was over, Teller remained a persistent advocate of what was called the super, specifically intended to intimidate the Soviet Union. Concern about the rebuilding, toughened, and militarized Soviet Union under Stalin, and the national paranoia in America called McCarthyism, eased Teller's path. A substantial obstacle was offered, though, in the person of Oppenheimer, who had become the chairman of the General Advisory Committee to the post-war Atomic Energy Commission. Teller provided critical testimony at a government hearing, questioning Oppenheimer's loyalty to the United States. Teller's involvement is generally thought to have played a major role in the aftermath. Although Oppenheimer's loyalty was not exactly impugned by the review board, somehow his security clearance was denied, he was retired from the AEC, and Teller's way to the super was greased. The technique for making a thermonuclear weapon is generally attributed to Teller and the mathematician Stanislas Ulam. Hans Bethe, the Nobel laureate physicist who headed the theoretical division at the Manhattan Project, and who played a major role in the development of both the atomic and the hydrogen bombs, attests that Teller's original suggestion was flawed, and that the work of many people was necessary to bring the thermonuclear weapon to reality. With fundamental technical contributions from a young physicist named Richard Garwin, the first U.S. thermonuclear device was exploded in 1952. It was too unwieldy to be carried by a missile or bomber. It just sat there, where it was assembled, and blew up. The first true hydrogen bomb was a Soviet invention, exploded 1 year later. There has been debate on whether the Soviet Union would have developed a thermonuclear weapon if the United States had not, and whether a U.S. thermonuclear weapon was even needed to deter Soviet use of their hydrogen bomb, since the U.S. by then possessed a substantial arsenal of fission weapons. The preponderance of current evidence is that the USSR, even before it exploded its first fission bomb, had a workable design for a thermonuclear weapon. It was the next logical step. But Soviet pursuit of fission weapons was much aided by the knowledge, from espionage, that the Americans were working on them. From my point of view, the consequences of global nuclear war became much more dangerous with the invention of the hydrogen bomb, because airbursts of thermonuclear weapons are much more capable of burning cities, generating vast amounts of smoke, cooling and darkening the earth, and inducing global-scale nuclear winter. This was perhaps the most controversial scientific debate I'd been involved in, from about 1983 to 1990. Much of the debate was politically driven. The strategic implications of nuclear winter were disquieting to those wedded to a policy of massive retaliation to deter a nuclear attack, or to those wishing to preserve the option of a massive first strike. In either case, the environmental consequences work the self-destruction of any nation launching large numbers of thermonuclear weapons, even with no retaliation from the adversary. A major segment of the strategic policy of decades, and the reason for accumulating tens of thousands of nuclear weapons, suddenly became much less credible. The global temperature declines, predicted in the original 1983 Nuclear Winter scientific paper, were 15 to 20 degrees Celsius. Current estimates are 10 to 15 degrees Celsius. The two values are in good agreement, considering the irreducible uncertainties in the calculations. Both temperature declines are much greater than the difference between current global temperatures and those of the last ice age. The long-term consequences of global thermonuclear war have been estimated by an international team of 200 scientists, who concluded that through nuclear winter, the global civilization and most of the people on Earth, including those far from the northern mid-latitude target zone, would be at risk, mainly from starvation. If large-scale nuclear war ever occurs, with cities targeted, the effort of Edward Teller and his colleagues in the United States, and the counterpart team headed by Andrei Sakharov in the Soviet Union, might be responsible for lowering the curtain on the human future. The hydrogen bomb is by far the most horrific weapon ever invented. When nuclear winter was discovered in 1983, Teller was quick to argue both, one, that the physics was mistaken, and two, that the discovery had been made years earlier under his tutelage at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. There is, in fact, no evidence for such a prior discovery, and considerable evidence that those in every nation charged to inform their national leaders of the effects of nuclear weapons had consistently overlooked nuclear winter. But if Teller is right, then it was unconscionable of him not to have disclosed the purported discovery to the affected parties, the citizens and the leaders of his nation and the world. As in the Stanley Kubrick movie Dr. Strangelove, classifying the ultimate weapon, so no one knows that it exists or what it can do, is the ultimate absurdity. It seems to me impossible for any normal human being to be untroubled by helping to make such an invention. Even putting nuclear winter aside, the stresses, conscious or unconscious, on those who take credit for the contrivance must be considerable. Whatever his actual contributions, Edward Teller has been widely described as the father of the hydrogen bomb. In an admiring 1954 article, Life magazine described his almost fanatic determination to build the hydrogen bomb. Much of his subsequent career can, I think, be understood as an attempt to justify what he begat. Teller has contended, not implausibly, that hydrogen bombs keep the peace, or at least prevent thermonuclear war, because the consequences of warfare between nuclear powers are now too dangerous. We haven't had a nuclear war yet, have we? But all such arguments assume that the nuclear-armed nations are, and always will be, without exception, rational actors, and that bouts of anger and revenge and madness will never overtake their leaders, or military and secret police officers in charge of nuclear weapons. In the century of Hitler and Stalin, this seems ingenuous. Teller has been a major force in preventing a comprehensive treaty banning nuclear weapons tests. He made it much more difficult to accomplish the 1963 Limited Above Ground Test Ban Treaty. His argument that above ground testing was essential to maintain and improve the nuclear arsenals, that ratifying the treaty would give away the future safety of our country, has proven specious he has also been a vigorous proponent of the safety and cost-effectiveness of fission power plants, claiming himself to be the only casualty of the Three Mile Island nuclear accident in Pennsylvania in 1979. He had a heart attack, he says, debating the issue. Teller advocated exploding nuclear weapons from Alaska to South Africa, to dredge harbors and canals, to obliterate troublesome mountains, to do heavy earth moving. When he proposed such a scheme to Queen Frederica of Greece, she is said to have responded, "Thank you, Dr. Teller, but Greece has enough quaint ruins already." Want to test Einstein's general relativity? Then explode a nuclear weapon on the far side of the sun, Teller proposed. Want to understand the chemical composition of the moon? Then fly a hydrogen bomb to the moon, explode it, and examine the spectrum of the flash and fireball. Also, in the 1980s, Teller sold President Ronald Reagan the notion of Star Wars, called by them the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI. Reagan seems to have believed a highly imaginative story of Teller's that it was possible to build a desk-sized, orbiting hydrogen bomb-driven X-ray laser that would destroy 10,000 Soviet warheads in flight and provide genuine protection for the citizens of the United States in case of global thermonuclear war. It is claimed by apologists for the Reagan administration that, whatever the exaggerations in capability, some of it intentional, SDI was responsible for the collapse of the Soviet Union. There is no serious evidence in support of this contention. Andrei Sakharov, Yevgeny Velikov, Roald Sagdiev, and other scientists who advised President Mikhail Gorbachev made it clear that if the United States really went ahead with a Star Wars program, the safest and cheapest Soviet response would be merely to augment its existing arsenal of nuclear weapons and delivery systems. In this way, Star Wars could have increased, not decreased, the peril of thermonuclear war. At any rate, Soviet expenditures on space-based defenses against American nuclear missiles were comparatively paltry, hardly of a magnitude to trigger a collapse of the Soviet economy. The fall of the USSR has much more to do with the failure of the command economy, growing awareness of the standard of living in the West, widespread disaffection from a moribund communist ideology, and, although he did not intend such an outcome, Gorbachev's promotion of glasnost, or openness. 10,000 American scientists and engineers publicly pledged they would not work on Star Wars or accept money from the SDI organization. This provides an example of widespread and courageous non-cooperation by scientists, at some conceivable personal cost, with a democratic government that had, temporarily at least, lost its way. Teller has also advocated the development of burrowing nuclear warheads, so underground command centers and deeply buried shelters for the leadership and their families of an adversary nation might be dug down to and wiped out. And 0.1 kiloton nuclear warheads that would saturate an enemy country, obliterating its infrastructure without a single casualty. Civilians would be alerted in advance. Nuclear war would be humane. As I write, Edward Teller, still vigorous and retaining considerable intellectual powers into his late 80s, has mounted a campaign with his counterparts in the former Soviet nuclear weapons establishment to develop and explode new generations of high-yield thermonuclear weapons in space in order to destroy or deflect asteroids that might be on collision trajectories with the Earth. I worry that premature experimentation with the orbits of nearby asteroids may involve extreme dangers for our species. Dr. Teller and I have met privately. We've debated at scientific meetings, in the national media, and in a closed rump session of Congress. We've had strong disagreements, especially on Star Wars, nuclear winter, and asteroid defense. Perhaps all this has hopelessly colored my view of him. Although he has always been a fervent anti-communist and technophile, as I look back over his life, it seems to me I see something more in his desperate attempt to justify the hydrogen bomb. Its effects aren't as bad as you might think. It can be used to defend the world from other hydrogen bombs, for science, for civil engineering, to protect the population of the United States against an enemy's thermonuclear weapons, to wage war humanely, to save the planet from random hazards from space. Somehow, somewhere, he wants to believe thermonuclear weapons and he will be acknowledged by the human species as its savior and not its destroyer. When scientific research provides fallible nations and political leaders with formidable, indeed awesome powers, many dangers present themselves. One is that some of the scientists involved may lose all but a superficial semblance of objectivity. As always, power tends to corrupt. In this circumstance, the institution of secrecy is especially pernicious, and the checks and balances of a democracy become especially valuable. Teller, who has flourished in the secrecy culture, has also repeatedly attacked it. The CIA Inspector General commented in 1995 that absolute secrecy corrupts absolutely. The most open and vigorous debate is often the only protection against the most perilous misuse of technology. The critical piece of the counter-argument may be something obvious that many scientists or even lay people could come up with, provided there were no penalties for speaking out. Or it might be something more subtle, something that would be noted by an obscure graduate student in some locale remote from Washington, D.C., who, if the arguments were closely held and highly secret, would never have the opportunity to address the issue. What realm of human endeavor is not morally ambiguous? Even folk institutions that purport to give us advice on behavior and ethics seem fraught with contradictions. Consider aphorisms. Haste makes waste. Yes, but a stitch in time saves nine. Better safe than sorry. But nothing ventured, nothing gained. Where there's smoke, there's fire. But you can't tell a book by its cover. A penny saved is a penny earned, but you can't take it with you. He who hesitates is lost, but fools rush in where angels fear to tread. Two heads are better than one, but too many cooks spoil the broth. There was a time when people planned or justified their actions on the basis of such contradictory platitudes. What is the moral responsibility of the aphorist? Or the sun sign astrologer, the tarot card reader, the tabloid prophet? Or consider the mainstream religions. We are enjoined in Micah to do justly and love mercy. In Exodus, we are forbidden to commit murder. In Leviticus, we are commanded to love our neighbor as ourselves. And in the Gospels, we are urged to love our enemies. Yet think of the rivers of blood spilled by fervent followers of the books in which these well-meaning exhortations are embedded. In Joshua, in the second half of Numbers, is celebrated the mass murder of men, women, children, down to the domestic animals in city after city across the whole land of Canaan. Jericho is obliterated in a kerem, a holy war. The only justification offered for this slaughter is the mass murderer's claim that, in exchange for circumcising their sons and adopting a particular set of rituals, their ancestors were long before promised that this land was their land. Not a hint of self-reproach, not a muttering of patriarchal or divine disquiet at these campaigns of extermination can be dug out of Holy Scripture. Instead, Joshua destroyed all that breathed, as the Lord God of Israel commanded. Joshua 10:40. And these events are not incidental, but central to the main narrative thrust of the Old Testament. Similar stories of mass murder, and in the case of the Amalekites' genocide, can be found in the books of Saul, Esther, and elsewhere in the Bible, with hardly a pang of moral doubt. It was all, of course, troubling to liberal theologians of a later age. It is properly said that the devil can quote scripture to his purpose. The Bible is full of so many stories of contradictory moral purpose that every generation can find scriptural justification for nearly any action it proposes, from incest, slavery, and mass murder, to the most refined love, courage, and self-sacrifice. And this moral, multiple personality disorder is hardly restricted to Judaism and Christianity. You can find it deep within Islam, the Hindu tradition, indeed nearly all the world's religions. Perhaps then it is not so much scientists as people who are morally ambiguous. It is the particular task of scientists, I believe, to alert the public to possible dangers, especially those emanating from science or foreseeable through the use of science. Such a mission is, you might say, prophetic. Clearly, the warnings need to be judicious and not more flamboyant than the dangers require. But if we must make errors, given the stakes, they should be on the side of safety. Among the Kung San hunter-gatherers of the Kalahari Desert, when two men, perhaps testosterone-inflamed, would begin to argue, the woman would reach for their poison arrows and put the weapons out of harm's way. Today, our poison arrows can destroy the global civilization and just possibly annihilate our species. The price of moral ambiguity is now too high. For this reason, and not because of its approach to knowledge, the ethical responsibility of scientists must also be high, extraordinarily high, unprecedentedly high. I wish graduate science programs explicitly and systematically raised these questions with fledgling scientists and engineers. And sometimes I wonder whether in our society too, the women and the children will eventually put the poison arrows out of harm's way. Chapter 17. The Marriage of Skepticism and Wonder. Nothing is too wonderful to be true. Remark attributed to Michael Faraday, 1791 to 1867. Insight, untested and unsupported, is an insufficient guarantee of truth. Bertrand Russell, Mysticism and Logic, 1929. When we are asked to swear in American courts of law that we will tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, we are being asked the impossible. It is simply beyond our powers. Our memories are fallible. Even scientific truth is merely an approximation. And we are ignorant about nearly all of the universe. Nevertheless, a life may depend on our testimony. To swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, to the limit of our abilities, is a fair request. Without the qualifying phrase, though, it's simply out of touch. But such a qualification, however consonant with human reality, is unacceptable to any legal system. If everyone tells the truth only to a degree determined by individual judgment, then incriminating or awkward facts might be withheld, events shaded, culpability hidden, responsibility evaded, and justice denied. So the law strives for an impossible standard of accuracy, and we do the best we can. In the jury selection process, the court needs to be reassured that the verdict will be based on evidence. It makes heroic efforts to weed out bias. It is aware of human imperfection. Does the potential juror personally know the district attorney, or the prosecutor, or the defense attorney? What about the judge, or the other jurors? Has she formed an opinion about this case, not from the facts laid out in court, but from pre-trial publicity? Will she assign evidence from police officers greater or lesser weight than evidence from witnesses for the defense? Is she biased against the defendant's ethnic group? Does the potential juror live in the neighborhood where the crimes were committed? And might that influence her judgment? Does she have a scientific background about matters on which expert witnesses will testify? This is often a count against her. Are any of her relatives or close family members employed in law enforcement or criminal law? Has she herself had any run-ins with police that might influence her judgment in the trial? Was any close friend or relative ever arrested on a similar charge? The American system of jurisprudence recognizes a wide range of factors, predispositions, prejudices, and experiences that might cloud our judgment or affect our objectivity, sometimes even without our knowing it. It goes to great, perhaps even extravagant lengths to safeguard the process of judgment in a criminal trial from the human weaknesses of those who must decide on innocence or guilt. Even then, of course, the process sometimes fails. Why would we settle for anything less when interrogating the natural world, or when attempting to decide on vital matters of politics, economics, religion, and ethics? If it is to be applied consistently, science imposes, in exchange for its manifold gifts, a certain onerous burden. We are enjoined, no matter how uncomfortable it might be, to consider ourselves and our cultural institutions scientifically, not to accept uncritically whatever we're told, to surmount as best we can our hopes, conceits, and unexamined beliefs, to view ourselves as we really are. Can we conscientiously and courageously follow planetary motion or bacterial genetics, wherever the search may lead, but declare the origin of matter or human behavior off-limits? Because its explanatory power is so great, once you get the hang of scientific reasoning, you're eager to apply it everywhere. However, in the course of looking deeply within ourselves, we may challenge notions that give comfort before the terrors of the world. I'm aware that some of the discussion in, say, the preceding chapter may have such a character. When anthropologists survey the thousands of distinct cultures and ethnicities that comprise the human family, they are struck by how few features there are that are givens, always present no matter how exotic the society. There are, for example, cultures. The Ik of Uganda is one, where all 10 commandments seem to be systematically, institutionally ignored. There are societies that abandon their old and their newborn, that eat their enemies, that use seashells or pigs or young women for money. But they all have a strong incest taboo. They all use technology, and almost all believe in a supernatural world of gods and spirits, often connected with the natural environment they inhabit and the well-being of the plants and animals they eat. The ones with a supreme god who lives in the sky tend to be the most ferocious, torturing their enemies, for example. But this is a statistical correlation only. The causal link has not been established, although speculations naturally present themselves. In every such society, there is a cherished world of myth and metaphor, which coexists with the workaday world. Efforts to reconcile the two are made, and any rough edges at the joints tend to be off-limits and ignored. We Compartmentalize. Some scientists do this too, effortlessly stepping between the skeptical world of science and the credulous world of religious belief, without skipping a beat. Of course, the greater the mismatch between these two worlds, the more difficult it is to be comfortable, with untroubled conscience, with both. In a life short and uncertain, it seems heartless to do anything that might deprive people of the consolation of faith when science cannot remedy their anguish. Those who cannot bear the burden of science are free to ignore its precepts. But we cannot have science in bits and pieces, applying it where we feel safe, and ignoring it where we feel threatened. Again, because we are not wise enough to do so. Except by sealing the brain off into separate, airtight compartments, how is it possible to fly in aeroplanes, listen to the radio, or take antibiotics while holding that the Earth is around 10,000 years old, or that all Sagittarians are gregarious and affable? Have I ever heard a skeptic wax superior and contemptuous? Certainly. I've even sometimes heard, to my retrospective dismay, that unpleasant tone in my own voice. There are human imperfections on both sides of this issue. Even when it's applied sensitively, scientific skepticism may come across as arrogant, dogmatic, heartless, and dismissive of the feelings and deeply held beliefs of others. And it must be said, some scientists and dedicated skeptics apply this tool as a blunt instrument, with little finesse. Sometimes, it looks as if the skeptical conclusion came first, that contentions were dismissed before, not after, the evidence was examined. All of us cherish our beliefs. They are, to a degree, self-defining. When someone comes along who challenges our belief system as insufficiently well-based, or who, like Socrates, merely ask embarrassing questions that we haven't thought of, or demonstrates that we've swept key underlying assumptions under the rug, it becomes much more than a search for knowledge. It feels like a personal assault. The scientist who first proposed to consecrate doubt as a prime virtue of the inquiring mind made it clear that it was a tool and not an end in itself. René Descartes wrote, "I did not imitate the skeptics, who doubt only for doubting's sake, and pretend to be always undecided. On the contrary, my whole intention was to arrive at a certainty, and to dig away the drift and the sand until I reached the rock or the clay beneath." In the way that skepticism is sometimes applied to issues of public concern, there is a tendency to belittle, to condescend, to ignore the fact that, deluded or not, supporters of superstition and pseudoscience are human beings with real feelings, who, like the skeptics, are trying to figure out how the world works, and what our role in it might be. Their motives are, in many cases, consonant with science. If their culture has not given them all the tools they need to pursue this great quest, let us temper our criticism with kindness. None of us comes fully equipped. Clearly, there are limits to the uses of skepticism. There is some cost-benefit analysis which must be applied. And if the comfort, consolation, and hope delivered by mysticism and superstition is high, and the dangers of belief comparatively low, should we not keep our misgivings to ourselves? But the issue is tricky. Imagine that you enter a big city taxicab, and the moment you get settled in, the driver begins a harangue about the supposed iniquities and inferiorities of another ethnic group. Is your best course to keep quiet, bearing in mind that silence conveys assent? Or is it your moral responsibility to argue with him, to express outrage, even to leave the cab, because you know that every silent assent will encourage him next time, and every vigorous dissent will cause him next time to think twice. Likewise, if we offer too much silent assent about mysticism and superstition, even when it seems to be doing a little good, we abet a general climate in which skepticism is considered impolite, science tiresome, and rigorous thinking somehow stuffy and inappropriate. Figuring out a prudent balance takes wisdom. The Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal is an organization of scientists, academics, magicians, and others dedicated to skeptical scrutiny of emerging or full-blown pseudosciences. It was founded by the University of Buffalo philosopher Paul Kurtz in 1976. I've been affiliated with it since its beginning. Its acronym, CSICOP, is pronounced PSYCOP, as if it's an organization of scientists performing a police function. Those wounded by PSYCOP's analyses sometimes make just such a complaint. It's hostile to every new idea, they say, will go to absurd lengths in its knee-jerk debunking, is a vigilante organization, a new inquisition, and so on. PSYCOP is imperfect. In certain cases, such a critique is to some degree justified. But from my point of view, PSYCOP serves an important social function. As a well-known organization to which the media can apply when they wish to hear the other side of the story, especially when some amazing claim of pseudoscience is adjudged newsworthy. It used to be, and for much of the global news media it still is, that every levitating guru, visiting alien, channeler, and faith healer, when covered by the media, would be treated non-substantively and uncritically. There would be no institutional memory at the television studio or newspaper or magazine about other similar claims, previously shown to be scams and bamboozles. PSYCOP represents a counterbalance, although not yet nearly a loud enough voice, to the pseudoscience gullibility that seems second nature to so much of the media. One of my favorite cartoons shows a fortune teller scrutinizing the mark's palm and gravely concluding, "You are very gullible." PSYCOP publishes a bi-monthly periodical called The Skeptical Inquirer. On the day it arrives, I take it home from the office and pore through its pages, wondering what new misunderstandings will be revealed. There's always another bamboozle that I never thought of. Crop circles. Aliens have come and made perfect circles and mathematical messages in wheat. Who would have thought it? So unlikely an artistic medium. Or they've come and eviscerated cows on a large scale, systematically. Farmers are furious. At first, I'm impressed by the inventiveness of the stories. But then, on more sober reflection, it always strikes me how dull and routine these accounts are. What a compilation of unimaginative, stale ideas, chauvinisms, hopes, and fears dressed up as facts. The contentions, from this point of view, are suspect on their face. That's all they can conceive the extraterrestrials doing? Making circles in wheat? What a failure of the imagination. With every issue, another facet of pseudoscience is revealed and criticized. And yet, the chief deficiency I see in the skeptical movement is in its polarization. Us versus them. The sense that we have a monopoly on the truth. That those other people who believe in all those stupid doctrines are morons. That if you're sensible, you'll listen to us, and if not, you're beyond redemption. This is unconstructive. It does not get the message across. It condemns the skeptics to permanent minority status, whereas a compassionate approach that from the beginning acknowledges the human roots of pseudoscience and superstition might be much more widely accepted. If we understand this, then of course we feel the uncertainty and the pain of the abductees, or of those who dare not leave home without consulting their horoscopes, or those who pin their hopes on crystals from Atlantis. And such compassion for kindred spirits in a common quest also works to make science and the scientific method less off-putting, especially to the young. Many pseudoscientific and New Age belief systems emerge out of dissatisfaction with conventional values and perspectives, and are therefore themselves a kind of skepticism. The same is true of the origins of most religions. David Hess, in Science and the New Age, argues that the world of paranormal beliefs and practices cannot be reduced to cranks, crackpots, and charlatans. A large number of sincere people are exploring alternative approaches to questions of personal meaning, spirituality, healing, and paranormal experience in general. To the skeptic, their quest may ultimately rest on a delusion, but debunking is hardly likely to be an effective rhetorical device for their rationalist project of getting people to recognize what appears to the skeptic as mistaken or magical thinking. The skeptic might take a clue from cultural anthropology and develop a more sophisticated skepticism by understanding alternative belief systems from the perspective of the people who hold them, and by situating these beliefs in their historical, social, and cultural contexts. As a result, the world of the paranormal may appear less as a silly turn towards irrationalism and more as an idiom through which segments of society express their conflicts, dilemmas, and identities. To the extent that skeptics have a psychological or sociological theory of New Age beliefs, it tends to be very simplistic. Paranormal beliefs are comforting to people who cannot handle the reality of an atheistic universe, or their beliefs are the product of an irresponsible media that is not encouraging the public to think critically. But Hess's just criticism promptly deteriorates into complaints that parapsychologists have had their careers ruined by skeptical colleagues, and that skeptics exhibit a kind of religious zeal to defend the materialistic and atheistic worldview that smacks of what has been called scientific fundamentalism or irrational rationalism. This is a common, but to me deeply mysterious, indeed occult, complaint. Again, we know a great deal about the existence and properties of matter. If a given phenomenon can already be plausibly understood in terms of matter and energy, why should we hypothesize that something else, something for which there is as yet no other good evidence, is responsible? Yet the complaint persists. Skeptics won't accept that there's an invisible fire-breathing dragon in my garage because they're all atheistic materialists. In Science in the New Age, skepticism is discussed, but it is not understood, and it is certainly not practiced. All sorts of paranormal claims are quoted. Skeptics are deconstructed, but you can never learn from reading it that there are ways to decide whether New Age and parapsychological claims to knowledge are promising or false. It's all, as in many postmodernist texts, a matter of how strongly people feel and what their biases may be. Robert Anton Wilson, in The New Inquisition, Irrational Rationalism and the Citadel of Science, Phoenix Falcon Press, 1986, describes skeptics as the New Inquisition. But to my knowledge, no skeptic compels belief. Indeed, on most TV documentaries and talk shows, skeptics get short shrift and almost no airtime. All that's happening is that some doctrines and methods are being criticized, at the worst, ridiculed, in magazines like The Skeptical Inquirer, with circulations of a few tens of thousands. New ages are not much, as in earlier times, being called up before criminal tribunals, nor whipped for having visions, and they are certainly not being burned at the stake. Why fear a little criticism? Aren't they interested to see how well their beliefs hold up against the best counter-arguments the skeptics can muster? Perhaps 1% of the time, someone who has an idea that smells, feels, and looks indistinguishable from the usual run of pseudoscience will turn out to be right. Maybe some undiscovered reptile left over from the Cretaceous period will indeed be found in Loch Ness or the Congo Republic. Or we will find artifacts of an advanced non-human species elsewhere in the solar system. At the time of writing, there are three claims in the ESP field which, in my opinion, deserve serious study. One, that by thought alone, humans can barely affect random number generators in computers. Two, that people under mild sensory deprivation can receive thoughts or images projected at them. And three, that young children sometimes report the details of a previous life, which, upon checking, turn out to be accurate, and which they could not have known about in any other way than reincarnation. I pick these claims not because I think they're likely to be valid, I don't, but as examples of contentions that might be true. The last three have at least some, although still dubious, experimental support. Of course, I could be wrong. In the middle 1970s, an astronomer I admire put together a modest manifesto called Objections to Astrology, and asked me to endorse it. I struggled with his wording, and in the end found myself unable to sign, not because I thought astrology has any validity whatever, but because I felt, and still feel, that the tone of the statement was authoritarian. It criticized astrology for having origins shrouded in superstition. But this is true as well for religion, chemistry, medicine, and astronomy, to mention only four. The issue is not what faltering and rudimentary knowledge astrology came from, but what is its present validity. Then there was the speculation on the psychological motivations of those who believe in astrology. These motivations, for example, the feeling of powerlessness in a complex, troublesome, and unpredictable world, might explain why astrology is not generally given the skeptical scrutiny it deserves, but is quite peripheral to whether it works. The statement stressed that we can think of no mechanism by which astrology could work. This is certainly a relevant point, but by itself, it's unconvincing. No mechanism was known for continental drift, now subsumed in plate tectonics, when it was proposed by Alfred Wegener in the first quarter of the 20th century, to explain a range of puzzling data in geology and paleontology. Ore-bearing veins of rocks and fossils seemed to run continuously from East and South America to West Africa. Were the two continents once touching, and the Atlantic Ocean new to our planet? The notion was roundly dismissed by all the great geophysicists, who were certain that continents were fixed, not floating on anything, and therefore unable to drift. Instead, the key 20th century idea in geophysics turns out to be plate tectonics. We now understand that continental plates do indeed float and drift, or better, are carried by a kind of conveyor belt, driven by the great heat engine of the Earth's interior. And all those great geophysicists were simply wrong. Objections to pseudoscience, on the grounds of unavailable mechanism, can be mistaken, although if the contentions violate well-established laws of physics, such objections, of course, carry great weight. Many valid criticisms of astrology can be formulated in a few sentences. For example, its acceptance of precession of the equinoxes in announcing an age of Aquarius, and its rejection of precession of the equinoxes in casting horoscopes, its neglect of atmospheric refraction, its list of supposedly significant celestial objects that is mainly limited to naked eye objects known to Ptolemy in the 2nd century, and that ignores an enormous variety of new astronomical objects discovered since. Where is the astrology of the near-Earth asteroids? Inconsistent requirements for detailed information on the time as compared to the latitude and longitude of birth. The failure of astrology to pass the identical twin test. The major differences in horoscopes cast from the same birth information by different astrologers, and the absence of demonstrated correlation between horoscopes and such psychological tests as the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. What I would have signed is a statement describing and refuting the principal tenets of astrological belief. Such a statement would have been far more persuasive than what was actually circulated and published. But astrology, which has been with us for 4,000 years or more, today seems more popular than ever. At least a quarter of all Americans, according to opinion polls, believe in astrology. A third think sun sign astrology is scientific. The fraction of school children believing in astrology rose from 40% to 59% between 1978 and 1984. There are perhaps 10 times more astrologers than astronomers in the United States. In France, there are more astrologers than Roman Catholic clergy. No stuffy dismissal by a gaggle of scientists makes contact with the social needs that astrology, no matter how invalid it is, addresses, and science does not. As I've tried to stress, at the heart of science is an essential balance between two seemingly contradictory attitudes: an openness to new ideas, no matter how bizarre or counterintuitive, and the most ruthlessly skeptical scrutiny of all ideas, old and new. This is how deep truths are winnowed from deep nonsense. The collective enterprise of creative thinking and skeptical thinking working together keeps the field on track. Those two seemingly contradictory attitudes are, though, in some tension. Consider this claim. As I walk along, time, as measured by my wristwatch or my aging process, slows down. Also, I shrink in the direction of motion. Also, I get more massive. Who has ever witnessed such a thing? It's easy to dismiss it out of hand. Here's another. Matter and antimatter are all the time, throughout the universe, being created from nothing. Here's a third. Once in a very great while, your car will spontaneously ooze through the brick wall of your garage and be found the next morning on the street. They're all absurd. But the first is a statement of special relativity, and the other two are consequences of quantum mechanics. Vacuum fluctuations and barrier tunneling, they're called. Like it or not, that's the way the world is. If you insist it's ridiculous, you'll be forever closed to some of the major findings on the rules that govern the universe. If you're only skeptical, then no new ideas make it through to you. You'll never learn anything. You become a crotchety misanthrope, convinced that nonsense is ruling the world. There is, of course, much data to support you. Since major discoveries at the borderlines of science are rare, experience will tend to confirm your grumpiness. But every now and then, a new idea turns out to be on the mark, valid and wonderful. If you're too resolutely and uncompromisingly skeptical, you're going to miss or resent the transforming discoveries in science. And either way, you will be obstructing understanding and progress. Mere skepticism is not enough. At the same time, Science requires the most vigorous and uncompromising skepticism, because the vast majority of ideas are simply wrong. And the only way to winnow the wheat from the chaff is by critical experiment and analysis. If you're open to the point of gullibility and have not a microgram of skeptical sense in you, then you cannot distinguish the promising ideas from the worthless ones. Uncritically accepting every proffered notion, idea, and hypothesis is tantamount to knowing nothing. Ideas contradict one another. Only through skeptical scrutiny can we decide among them. Some ideas really are better than others. The judicious mix of these two modes of thought is central to the success of science. Good scientists do both. On their own, talking to themselves, they churn up many new ideas and criticize them systematically. Most of the ideas never make it to the outside world. Only those that pass a rigorous self-filtration make it out to be criticized by the rest of the scientific community. Because of this dogged mutual criticism and self-criticism, and the proper reliance on experiment as the arbiter between contending hypotheses, many scientists tend to be diffident about describing their own sense of wonder at the dawning of a wild surmise. This is a pity, because these rare exultant moments demystify and humanize the scientific endeavor. No one can be entirely open or completely skeptical. We all must draw the line somewhere. An ancient Chinese proverb advises, "Better to be too credulous than too skeptical." But this is from an extremely conservative society in which stability was much more prized than freedom, and where the rulers had a powerful vested interest in not being challenged. Most scientists, I believe, would say, better to be too skeptical than too credulous. But neither is easy. Responsible, thoroughgoing, rigorous skepticism requires a hard-nosed habit of thought that takes practice and training to master. Credulity, I think a better word here is openness or wonder, does not come easily either. If we really are to be open to the counterintuitive ideas in physics or social organization or anything else, we must grasp those ideas. It means nothing to be open to a proposition we don't understand. Both skepticism and wonder are skills that need honing and practice. Their harmonious marriage within the mind of every schoolchild ought to be a principal goal of public education. I'd love to see such a domestic felicity portrayed in the media, television especially. A community of people really working the mix, full of wonder, generously open to every notion, dismissing nothing except for good reason, but at the same time, and as second nature, demanding stringent standards of evidence. And these standards applied with at least as much rigor to what they hold dear as to what they are tempted to reject with impunity.